short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima.
Ich bin ein Berliner.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this.
The American people, I think, is good people. They have not to charge with the guilty of all the lies.
To the Cold War, episode 155, special edition. My guest today is Archie Brown. Now, you've heard me talk about Archie Brown before. Big fan of Archie Brown. Read a number of his books over the years on the history of communism. He is a British political scientist and historian, the emeritus professor of politics at the University of Oxford, and an emeritus fellow at St. Anthony's College, Oxford. And he's one of the world's leading experts on Soviet and Russian politics, the Cold War, communist politics, etc. Great book he wrote back in the 2000s called The Rise and Fall of Communism, which I highly recommend. He wrote a book in the mid-90s called The Gorbachev Factor. And he's got a new book out, The Human Factor, which talks about the end of the Cold War, so skipping a little bit ahead in our timeline, probably 20 years ahead, the rate we're going at. But it's talking about what happened in the late 80s, early 90s to end the Cold War. Now, I didn't get into it with him about, well, did the Cold War really end, et cetera, et cetera. Not the time nor the place. I would have loved to have talked to him about Stalin and all of that kind of stuff too, but he made it clear in our email conversations that he really wanted to talk about the new book and not delve in all of that kind of stuff, which is fair enough. Archie's in his 80s and, you know, he doesn't have time to talk to some young pup like me about all the nerdy stuff that I will get into. He's promoting his book. Anyway, I really, you'll be able to tell on this, I really, really enjoyed talking to Archie, and I hope you enjoy it too. Here it is. Archie, this is Cameron Riley.
Oh, yes, hello.
How are you, sir?
Okay, thanks. Still surviving. No coronavirus so far.
I'm so glad to hear it.
Yeah. You okay?
I'm very well, thank you, sir, and it's an honour and a privilege to talk to you.
No, it's a pleasure.
So let's talk about your latest book, The Human Factor. Now, I was 21 years old when the Cold War ended. And along with most people my age, I was led to understand that the reason it ended was primarily because Ronald Reagan gave his tear down this wall speech in Berlin, and the Soviets were so incredibly embarrassed as a result of that speech that they just gave up and ended the Cold War. And I'm sure most of our American listeners would believe that that's fairly close to the story. Your book takes issue with that.
Yes, I think that is quite a widespread view, perhaps especially in the United States. But I think it's also almost completely wrong that, in fact, Reagan's speech in Berlin, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, would have made it harder for Gorbachev to get the wall torn down. And in fact, 2 weeks earlier, he and the Soviet foreign minister, Shevardnadze, had been in East Germany, and they'd encouraged the East German leadership to dismantle the wall, but Honecker, the East German leader, would have none of it. In fact, by that time, Gorbachev was not trying to dictate policy in any way to the East Europeans. He was letting them to get settle matters for themselves. Similarly, a year later, when the East European peoples took Gorbachev at his word, and because in a speech in the United Nations in 1988, he said the people of every country had the right to decide for themselves what kind of system, political and economic, they wish to live under. The following year, people in Eastern Europe tested that hypothesis and found that Gorbachev meant what he said. So, excuse me, the in fact, you know, Gorbachev was the crucial person in the end of the Cold War. When his predecessor, Chernenko, died in March 1985, the next leader had to be chosen from the 10 full members of the Politburo who were still standing. A lot of them were pretty old and only just standing. We know the views and mindsets of all 10. And, you know, I can absolutely assure you that the only one who would have pursued the kind of policies that Gorbachev did was Gorbachev.
So how did he end up as general secretary then? It seems in retrospect quite an improbable turn of events.
It was in many ways an improbable turn of events. And he wasn't chosen because he was a softliner, as again some people imagine. He was chosen because he was very skillful at intra-party maneuvering. He was very able, very hard-working. He had impressed Andropov. Andropov, you know, became leader before Chernenko, and he accelerated Gorbachev's promotion within the top leadership team. And so when Andropov died and Chernenko became the leader, Gorbachev then moved into the position of second secretary, even though there were people in the old guard who would have liked to have stopped his ascent. He was sufficiently entrenched within the central committee machine that by that time that he was able to get the number two position. And when Chernenko died, I mean, he himself in a way seized the throne. He convened a meeting of the Politburo the very evening in which Chernenko died, took the chair and was elected chair of Chernenko's funeral commission. Well, Sovietologists like myself knew that in the last three occasions when somebody died, the person who was chair of the funeral commission was the person who became the next leader. And within 24 hours, he was Soviet leader. So it wasn't as if, you know, he was chosen by the Soviet bureaucracy. In a sense, you know, he seized the opportunity.
That reminds me of sort of a tradition in ancient Macedon. When the Macedonian king died, whoever supervised the funeral was next in line to be king.
Uh-huh.
Wonder if the Soviets adopted that from Alexander the Great. So let's talk about Gorbachev as a good place to kick it off. Your book, you talk about he had a very humble beginning, came out of a family of poor peasants. His grandfathers had been arrested during Stalin's terror. He seems like an unlikely person to end up running the Soviet government.
Yes, that's true. Of course, many people had relatives arrested in the 1930s, but it wasn't exactly a commendation if you wanted to make your career within the Soviet Communist Party hierarchy. Gorbachev, both the grandfathers were arrested at different times in the 30s on trumped-up charges, as most people in those days who were arrested were. But he had some compensating factors, and he was a very bright student. He was active in the Komsomol, the Young Communist League. But above all, when his father returned from the war, his father had been fighting at the front, Gorbachev helped him in a combine harvester every summer, and they produced a record harvest in their area, the two of them working together, and were given state awards. The father was given the Order of Lenin. Gorbachev was given the Order of Red Banner of Labour at the age of 17. Now, I know people who were at university in Moscow with Gorbachev and said, you know, some of the older students who'd fought in the war, you know, wore the red banner, but Gorbachev was the only younger student who had been too young to fight in the war, who had this red banner of labor, which he sometimes wore on his lapel. So, you know, having been an exemplary worker, as well as a very bright student, got a silver medal at school, you know, that helped him to get into Moscow University law faculty, which is a pretty unusual thing because it's the best university, was regarded at the time as the best university in the country. And, you know, somebody from a peasant family in southern Russia had very high odds stacked against him for getting there.
And of course, you know, without the revolution, that would have been absolutely impossible.
That's true. And so this is why Gorbachev for a long time was an exemplary party member, in the sense that he thought, you know, the party had provided people like him with the opportunity to fulfill their talents and abilities to the full. And so, you know, he sincerely believed in the system, and of course he thought it could be improved. He didn't blame Stalin personally for the arrest of his grandfathers, in common with many people who had relatives arrested or killed. And it was only when Nikita Khrushchev in 1956 made his famous so-called secret speech that didn't remain secret for long, and detailed the crimes of Stalin and showed the extent to which Stalin personally had orchestrated the great purges, it was only then that people like Gorbachev and others who had lost family members realized Stalin's culpability.
So Gorbachev was born in 31. He would have been in his, he would have been 22 when Stalin died. So he's old enough to be aware of what was going on at some level. Obviously, already had received some attention. What was his attitude towards Stalin later on in life? Do you know?
Oh, from the time, certainly, of Khrushchev's speech, he was an anti-Stalinist. And I knew somebody who was his best friend at Moscow University, a man who was a young Czech communist who was very active in the Prague Spring in 1968. He was in the leadership, and you know, was very influential, along with Dubček, in some ways more influential on the policies adopted than Dubček, a man called Zdeněk Mlynář. And he was Gorbachev's best friend when they studied together in the law faculty of Moscow University between 1950 and 55. And in a conversation I had with Mlynář in June 1979, long before Gorbachev was Soviet leader, he described Gorbachev to me as an anti-Stalinist, intelligent, and a person with an open mind. And so from that time onwards, I took a special interest in Gorbachev.
So when, my understanding from reading your book is that Gorbachev, obviously very intelligent, and his views evolved over time. What was it, do you think, that got him to the point where he started to think the USSR needed to be opened up to more democracy and more freedom? What led him to that conclusion?
I think his foreign visits had an impact on him. Even in the 1970s, he visited Italy, France, West Germany, and then in 1984, he was in Britain. He was also in Canada, you know, he obviously saw the higher standard of living in North America and in Western Europe, but I think there's no doubt he was also impressed by the freedom of discussion. I mean, in his memoirs, he comments on the fact that when he went abroad in a Soviet delegation, they all had to be very careful to say the same thing and toe the party line, and he noticed how the way in which Westerners would contradict each other and argue among themselves, you know, in discussion with a Soviet group. And he was simply impressed by that. Also, when he went to the funeral of the Italian communist leader Enrico Berlinguer, you know, the Italian president was there and various dignitaries of the Italian state, and, you know, bowed before the coffin. And Gorbachev said, you know, this was an example of a different political culture, you know, very different from ours. but clearly it was a political culture which appealed to him.
Hmm. And so you say that by the time, well, when he became General Secretary, the authority, the power of the General Secretary was such that he had the ability to push through reforms which, you know, it was to a large degree unimpeded, the combination of the authority and his ability as a politician. But if I understand correctly, Western observers didn't really see it coming. Is that correct? It was a big surprise to people in the West at the time?
There was argument among observers of the Soviet Union at the time, you know, between people who thought that, you know, significant change might be beginning to take place and those who thought it's all cosmetic and nothing fundamental can change. And of course, it became more radical with each successive year. I mean, Gorbachev had to tread carefully because when he was, first of all, General Secretary, then the other members of the Politburo were not people he had chosen, and he got rid in 1985 of several of the old guard, Grishin and Romanov, but he only gradually could he change the composition, and even then he never had a Politburo that had a majority of radical reformers, so he had to maneuver. But he was very persuasive, and he wasn't a dictator. Sometimes the Politburo would be resistant to proposals he put forward, and he would say, well, we need to think about this a bit more. And he would influence some exercise influence behind the scenes, persuade one or two people, bring it back to the Politburo a few weeks later, and then get their collective agreement for it. And that was quite important because, you know, once they'd accepted collective responsibility for the new policy, it was harder for them to blame everything on Gorbachev, though of course later some of them did.
Mm. Well, let's move on to the other two major characters in your book, Reagan and Thatcher. Let's start with Reagan. As I said at the beginning, you know, I think in the popular consciousness, there is this view that the Americans won the Cold War and they defeated the Soviet Union through a combination of superior military threats and economic superiority. What role do you believe Ronald Reagan played in the events that occurred in the late 80s, early 90s?
Reagan was a mixed blessing for Gorbachev. With his obsession with anti-missile defense and SDI, so-called Star Wars Strategic Defense Initiative, he was really making it harder for Gorbachev because the military-industrial complex regarded this as the United States seeking a first-strike capability against the Soviet Union. And the obvious answer to any attempt to build a defensive system against incoming missiles was to greatly increase the number of missiles, and that you would have some with multiple warheads, some would carry nuclear warheads and some would be dummies, but making the already almost impossible task of anti-missile defense, you know, really impossible. But this meant an acceleration of the arms race, and Gorbachev was determined to avoid that. He wanted to bring the arms race to an end. So he had a real struggle with his own military-industrial complex. So that aspect of Reagan's policy, the defense build-up, the anti-Soviet rhetoric, calling the Soviet Union in 1983 an evil empire, and especially his Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI, that made things very difficult for Gorbachev. However, Reagan also had a real hatred of nuclear weapons. Whereas Margaret Thatcher really believed in nuclear weapons as a great deterrent, Reagan wanted to rid the world of nuclear weapons. And so he was a kind of big picture person. And in that respect, you know, he was able to strike a chord sometimes with Gorbachev. And he was ready to engage. That was important. There were people in the American administration who thought there's no point in speaking with a Soviet leader. They'll never change. And, you know, they discouraged him from doing so. But once George Shultz, it wasn't just Reagan, of course, once George Shultz became Secretary of State, he was a considerable influence on Reagan, and he was somebody who did believe in dialogue with the Soviet Union, and the two of them, you know, proceeded to engage in that dialogue. And without it, of course, the Cold War couldn't have come to an end. So I would say that Gorbachev was the more crucial person by far, but he did need the President of the United States who would engage with him.
I did like the part of your book where you were talking about Reagan's conservative, hardline, anti-Soviet credentials almost gave him permission to be able to sit down and talk with Gorbachev. If he had been perceived to be soft on the Soviet Union or soft on Russia, he may have copped more flack stateside. It reminds me of the part of our show we've talked about in a lot of detail over the last couple of years when Truman became president and had to build up his credibility as not being soft on Russia after Yalta and the end of the war, etc., etc. He had to almost double down in terms of his rhetoric, which seemed to have put Stalin and Molotov offside and fractured the relationship even further than it was already struggling. But Reagan managed to get away with it because he was already seen to be such an anti-Soviet leader.
That's true. That's one of the respects in which he was useful for Gorbachev, because a liberal Republican and still more a liberal Democrat in Washington would have had a much harder time at home and would have been seen to be selling out. And even Reagan was accused by some people of having gone soft in communism or have been charmed into gullibility by Gorbachev. But, you know, those accusations didn't have much resonance with the American population because, you know, Reagan's anti-communist, anti-Soviet credentials had been built up over many years.
Yeah, it reminds me that, you know, how Roosevelt was attacked posthumously as well for having been hoodwinked by Stalin at Yalta when, you know, I think he's been done a great disservice. I think he was crucial in keeping the alliance together.
Yes, that's true. And even Truman, as you mentioned earlier, was initially rather fond of Stalin. I mean, in one of his letters or diaries, I think it was, he wrote, you know, he wasn't sure what would happen if Joe should pass out. You know, he didn't think that Molotov or other potential successors were as sincere as Joe was, and that was Stalin. later, of course, you know, he changed his mind very radically. But yes, Stalin was capable of charming people at times. Even Churchill, who was a lifelong anti-communist, you know, got rather a soft spot for Stalin at various points during the war, though again he very rapidly reverted to his earlier position immediately after the war when he saw the way in which the Soviet Union was expanding across Eastern Europe, their influence and power.
Well, yes, but slightly hypocritical for the man who didn't want to see the British Empire broken up under his stewardship to complain about somebody else building an economic block, don't you think?
Well, yeah, Churchill certainly was an old imperialist, yes, but well, it's a different subject to start comparing the British Empire and the Soviet one, but that's for another discussion another day, I think.
Fair enough. So, okay, so Reagan's abrasive rhetoric not really useful, in fact, perhaps a hindrance, but his willingness and his political credibility that enabled him to sit down and talk about scaling back the nuclear stalemate was useful. Let's talk about Margaret Thatcher. What role do you think she really played in the end of the Cold War?
In some ways, her role is the most surprising because the disparity between British military power and that of the Soviet Union and the United States was very great. But her influence arose in the first place because she was far and away Ronald Reagan's favourite foreign leader, and he referred to her on several occasions as his soulmate, political and ideological soulmate. They really saw eye to eye on economic policy. They didn't like state interference in the economy. I mean, sometimes the state became quite powerful under them, actually, but in principle, they were against state regulation and believed in the free market and so forth, and were both lifelong anti-communist, hardline anti-Soviet, and believed in military build-up. So they saw eye to eye in a whole lot of areas. And also, while many people were put off by Margaret Thatcher's style of speech, Reagan saw her as a kind of exemplary exponent of views that he himself held but couldn't articulate as clearly when he didn't have a script. That was a source of her influence. As long as Reagan was in the White House, she had a lot of clout in Washington. And she had good relations with both Shultz, the Secretary of State, and Weinberger, the Defense Secretary, who didn't get on with each other. And she was regarded as a hardliner. So when she was in favor of engagement with Gorbachev, and when she said that Gorbachev was a different kind of Soviet leader from any we've ever seen, this had undoubted influence. And then the still more surprising part of it is that she established a very good relationship with Gorbachev. Mm. 3 months before Gorbachev became Soviet leader, he came to Britain for a week-long visit, which was a great success. And he and Margaret Thatcher had a long discussion at the Prime Minister's country home, Chequers. They argued a lot, but nevertheless, they got on well. And at the end of that, she famously said, "I like Mr. Gorbachev, we can do business together." And almost immediately after, she went off to see Reagan and Shultz and in the United States at Camp David meeting, and repeated her very favorable impression of Gorbachev. So, and then with Gorbachev, she met him more often than even Churchill during the war met Stalin. No British prime minister has ever had as many meetings with an American president or with a Soviet leader as Margaret Thatcher had. And the relationship became warmer with each year with Gorbachev, started with mutual respect and finished up as friends. So that really was rather surprising, but she did play a considerable role.
Hmm. Fascinating. So so we get through to they're getting towards the end of it. One of the things that I've always been fascinated with is the not one inch promise that was made regarding the expansion of NATO should the Soviet Union agree to let go of Germany. Now, you say in the book that it was kind of something that was breezed over in discussions.
Yes, nobody was thinking at that time about NATO expansion, really. So Gorbachev eventually agreed to that a united Germany could be in NATO. But, the relationship was so good at that time between the United States and the Soviet Union and between George Bush and Gorbachev at that time, Bush the Elder, I don't think either of them were seriously contemplating expansion of NATO. And in the back of Gorbachev's mind, especially after the Warsaw Pact ceased to exist, I'm sure he was thinking that NATO has got no purpose anymore. It was set up to combat Soviet communism. Before long, there was no Soviet Union. Already by that time, there was little left of communism. The East European countries had become non-communist and independent. So, what purpose could there be for NATO? Still less, an expanded NATO. So I think that these promises were given, but it wasn't a big issue at the time. It became a big issue later when NATO did indeed expand. And then people could say, to the extent it was a promise that was made to a leader of a country that no longer exists, the Soviet Union. I still think, one could say that that was a bit dishonest. Though at the time, I'm sure that the promises were made in good faith by people like James Baker, the American Secretary of State, when he said, you know, there'd be no further expansion of NATO. That was his intention at the time.
So it was successive American administrations that reneged on at least the spirit of that deal, even if they found ways to talk their way around it.
They did, yes. I mean, within the Clinton administration, there were people who were reluctant to see this happen. The specialist within that administration on the Soviet Union, Strobe Talbot, was not very keen on NATO expansion, and Bill Perry, the defense secretary, thought it was a thoroughly bad idea. But the East Europeans were pressing very hard for it, and so one by one they were admitted, and then finally we got former republics of the Soviet Union, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, in the first instance, joining NATO. So for Russians, I mean, this was a real blow. First of all, countries that had been their subordinates and allies joined what had always been a hostile military alliance. And then people who'd been part of their country, the same country, the former republics of the Soviet Union, they started joining NATO. So it's not surprising that over the years this became more and more of a sensitive issue, to say the least, within Russia.
Mm. So Donald Trump seems to be keen to disband NATO. Do you think it's a good idea or a bad idea?
Well, you could argue this is the wrong time. You can't rewrite history, but there was a great opportunity at the end of the Cold War to build on something like the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, OSCE, as a new security organization that would embrace the whole of Europe and the United States and Canada, because they were part of that. This would have avoided the kind of division between Russia and the West, and indeed between Russia and Ukraine, which we see now. There is an argument that, you know, NATO fulfilled its historic purpose, and what is its purpose today? It's not entirely clear. I would hesitate to endorse any policy of Donald Trump.
Fair enough, too. Particularly on record, you wouldn't want to do that. So let's talk about what went wrong. So my understanding has always been that Gorbachev never really intended to see the Soviet Union disbanded and broken up. He thought he would be able to hold it together, just provide more democracy and more freedom. Am I right in thinking that?
Yes, you are. And there are many things that Gorbachev didn't really intend in 1985. But some of them he certainly did intend as the years went on, because, you know, I mentioned earlier that he had an open mind, and that open mind was crucial. He continued to develop his ideas while he was the General Secretary of the Soviet Communist Party, and he began in 1985 as a communist reformer. By 1988, he had come to the conclusion that the system was beyond reform and needed to be much more comprehensively transformed, and he became a systemic reformer. And he introduced competitive elections for a legislature with real power, and that met for the first time in 1989. So those things he did intend, and they changed the nature of the system. But once you had given people the opportunity to throw out their local leaders, then in the Baltic Republics, for example, you know, people who were chairman of the Council of Ministers in Estonia or Latvia or Lithuania, they were not elected to this legislature, and people used the new opportunities to express their national grievances. And grievances that had been suppressed, all kinds of grievances, for 70 years came to the surface of political life, and not least the various national discontents. So the threat to the national unity of the country, that was very much an unintended consequence of Gorbachev's fundamental political changes. And he did not want to see the Soviet Union break up. So there's a big distinction between ending the Cold War that Gorbachev wanted, transforming the Soviet political system, certainly he wanted to do that. But the breakup of the Soviet Union was something he was seeking to avoid, and he hoped to do it by getting the various components of the Federation to agree to a new genuine Federation with a lot of powers devolved to the republics instead of the pseudo-Federation that had been the Soviet Union up to that point. He made a certain amount of progress with that, and a number of the republics, including the biggest, Russia and Ukraine, had signed up to it. But there were a series of draft union treaties, and each one devolved more and more power to the republics. And in the last 2 years, Gorbachev was losing authority at home, and Yeltsin's popularity was being enhanced. It was in May, June 1990 that, according to the best public opinion polls, Yeltsin overtook Gorbachev as the most popular politician in the country, and that continued to accelerate. So a combination of Yeltsin playing the Russian card against the Union, saying that Russian law had supremacy over Soviet law, and then finally the coup against Gorbachev in August 1991, that really finished the Union off. But there's no doubt that Gorbachev was deeply disappointed by the breakup of the Soviet Union.
And did he remain a socialist at that stage? Was he just like a Deng Xiaoping trying to reform socialism in the country, or had he given up on socialism as being viable?
It's an interesting question, because he did consider himself to be a socialist throughout, but he fundamentally redefined what he meant by socialism. And I think a lot of observers fail to understand Gorbachev, especially those who say that he never changed because he always remained a socialist. The term socialist can cover a great many different political outlooks. And people who were members of Soviet Communist Party, they called themselves socialists. And Gorbachev, as I mentioned, began as a communist reformer, but still recognizably a socialist in the Soviet sense. But in the course of his time of less than 7 years in the Kremlin, he evolved into a socialist of a West European type, Willy Brandt in Germany or Labour Party in Britain. And actually his favourite foreign leader was not Reagan or Thatcher, it was Felipe González, the Spanish socialist prime minister. And it wasn't the Spanish Communist Party, which was wasn't such a small party. It wasn't the Communist Party in Spain, which was actually quite revisionist under Carrillo, but the Spanish socialist prime minister, with whom he had long conversations on the meaning of socialism. And so, he believed in the kind of democratic socialism that people like Clement Attlee did in the Labour Party traditionally in Britain, political democracy, freedom, welfare state, certain amount of public ownership. But, he could have fitted perfectly into a West European democratic socialist party by the end. So in that sense, he remained a socialist, but when you use the word remain, it disguises or it really obscures the extent to which his political evolution continued and just how much his real political outlook changed.
Sounds like he would have made a good Menshevik.
Yeah, he was probably to the right of the Mensheviks latterly. The Mensheviks were perhaps more thoroughgoing socialists than Gorbachev was latterly. He was more of a social democrat latterly.
Mm. What was his relationship with Deng Xiaoping like? Did he have much contact with him? They were both sort of reforming their countries in somewhat slightly different ways.
The only time they met was in 1989 when Gorbachev went to China. And, of course, there were demonstrations in Tiananmen Square at that time. People were encouraged by what was happening in the Soviet Union. No, he certainly respected Deng Xiaoping's economic reforms and his anti-Maoist policies. But Deng Xiaoping remained a Leninist in a way, believing in firm party control in a way that Gorbachev did not. I mean, Gorbachev had a kind of historic esteem for Lenin personally, but he basically ceased to be a Leninist and, as I said, evolved into a social democrat. So, but they didn't argue about that. But when they met, I mean, Gorbachev was very keen to restore or re-establish the relationship with China, which had been very bad between China and the Soviet Union for many years. So he was pleased to meet with Deng Xiaoping, and he kept away from the demonstrators. The demonstrators were quite keen on Gorbachev, but he knew that it was an extremely sensitive issue for the Chinese leadership, and given that he'd gone there in order to improve the Sino-Soviet relationship, he couldn't go and mix with the demonstrators. So I think what we also know from his conversations with the French President Mitterrand and Helmut Kohl, he thoroughly disapproved of the brutal crackdown in Tiananmen Square, which put an end to the protests. But again, he didn't condemn it very overtly in public because he didn't want to spoil the new developing relationship, re-established relationship with China.
So let's talk about how Gorbachev is perceived in Russia today. Is he admired, revered, or do people regret his actions?
On the whole, people take a very dim view of Gorbachev now. He tends to be criticized. He's regarded as somebody who is weak. He's blamed by Russians above all for the breakup of the Soviet Union. Now, there is a minority who esteem him very highly, a minority in Russia who value what he did, but the majority do not. And that's partly because of the way he's been treated in the media over the years since then. It's become probably a bit easier to praise Stalin in the Russian mass media than it has to praise Gorbachev. Even Russia today is nothing like as authoritarian as the pre-perestroika Soviet Union. So Gorbachev can publish books in Russia, and there can be books published which are sympathetic to him, but they've got small circulations. The media, which are most influential, especially television, they would be almost uniformly hostile to Gorbachev. They feel that, in a sense, the Soviet Union lost the Cold War and that Gorbachev sold them down the river, and they blame him for the breakup of the Soviet Union. Now, I think, anybody who reads my book would find that was a huge oversimplification, to put it mildly, but that is the prevailing view.
And I assume that he doesn't have much of a relationship with Vladimir Putin?
No, he doesn't. Even less with Yeltsin. He was not invited to the Kremlin even once all the time that Yeltsin was leader. I think he's been there maybe once or twice, but not at all in recent years when Putin was there.
And finally, do you have any idea what Gorbachev's view is of Russia today? He's in his late 80s, I think. Is he proud of what he did, or does he regret his actions?
He doesn't regret his actions. He thinks that not only Russia, but the world in general is not built on the foundations that were laid by the end of the 1980s. When there was a possibility of having a qualitatively new international relationship. I mean, no NATO, no Warsaw Pact, a new security organization. He is extremely concerned by the fact that successful attempts to cut the number of nuclear weapons, which were achieved between Reagan and Gorbachev and Bush and Gorbachev, are now being lost. I mean, already in 2001, the George W. Bush administration abrogated one of the treaties, and last year another was lost. So what's happening in arms build-up again worries him a lot. He's also extremely unhappy about the fact that Russia has become more authoritarian than it was in the last years of the Soviet Union. Not as authoritarian as it was in the pre-perestroika days, but still, there was a much more vibrant political life and much more criticism in parliament and in the mass media, for example, in the last years of the Soviet Union than in contemporary Russia. So there's a lot that's happened since, which he doesn't approve of at all. But he doesn't have any regrets about his role in ending the Cold War, nor his role in making Russia a freer country than it's ever been in 1,000 years.
Well, just to sum up your thoughts, are there lessons to be learnt from this story, the human factor, Archie?
I think there are, yes. Many of the things which Gorbachev was trying to do still need to be done. I mean, he was actually one of the people who was concerned long before most politicians about environmental issues. He was a very green politician, more green than red in a way, and he's been extremely concerned about environmental degradation and climate change. But I think one of the lessons is that you need to have engagement, that it's never been the case that isolation of Russia has made it a more liberal or a more democratic country. And one of the things which brought about change in the Soviet Union was a certain amount of contact between party intellectuals in Russia and even people who are high up in the hierarchy, like Gorbachev or one of his closest associates at that time, Alexander Yakovlev, who'd seen a lot of the West and who became more dissatisfied with their own system the more they saw of a developed Western democracy. So there are people who think, well, Russia now has gone backwards and you know, the less you have to do with them, the better. Now, that's a big mistake, because you must engage if you want to exert any influence.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, without wanting to sound like either of us admire or support Donald Trump's presidency, he at least seems to be willing to engage with Kim and Putin and other leaders. He cops a lot of criticism for it, but I do think it makes more sense to sit down at the table and have discussions with these people than just to shut them out and treat them as verboten.
Yes, I think in the case of Kim, I mean, Trump probably was deluded that, I mean, he was getting really nothing in return. I mean, Trump is so ignorant and so full of himself that he could make a very bad deal. So, again, I would hate to have Trump as the kind of exemplar of the policy that I am advocating. But it is true that in the case of Russia that it's unfortunate that the Democrats, you know, have concentrated so much power on him for wanting to have a better relationship with Russia, because there's a lot to be said for the United States having a better relationship with Russia. And there are a great many things that one can attack Trump over rather than that. Now, it may well be that he wants a better relationship for the wrong reasons. And many of the things that Trump wants are for the wrong reasons. So that's the problem. But I think that better relations with Russia are desirable, even if Trump also wants them.
As you say, I'm pretty sure it has more to do with Trump hotels in Moscow than any other overarching big vision.
That seems entirely plausible, yeah.
But do you have any thoughts on why the Democrats have demonized his relationship with Russia? As a Cold War nerd, it always strikes me that they're just rehashing old McCarthyism. I found the whole Russiagate narrative over the last few years to be ridiculous and laughable.
Well, I think there is an element of conditioned reflex there, but they think it's a very vulnerable spot of Trump's. I mean, they thought that. I mean, now, in fact, the way he's treated the coronavirus should make a much more obvious point of vulnerability for him, because, you know, if you just go over all his statements there, they've been absolutely absurd. And, you know, first of all, it was just a minor thing, nothing, something that the Democrats had made up, more or less. Mm-hmm. But and then now we've got more people dying in the United States than anywhere else. But so perhaps that will get the Democrats off their obsession with Trump and Russia, because it was becoming a bit obsessive.
Mm. Well, Archie, as you know, I've said to you in our email discussions prior to this, I'm a huge fan of your work. I would love to sit and talk to you for hours about Soviet history, but I appreciate your new book very much. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you for taking the time to write it for those of us that have an interest in the history of the period, and thank you for coming on and chatting with us this morning.
Thank you very much.
All right, sir, that's it. You're happy with that?
An iron curtain has descended across the continent.
From the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba, the purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere.